Chapter 22. Hans Chotek sat down heavily in the chair, which he immediately reminded himself was a mistake. The furniture provided by the Jirapatha for use by their human guests was either cartoonishly large and overly soft, or barely sized for comfort and hard as a rock. The too small bed in his assigned quarters had three levels of firmness. Unfortunately, they ranged from concrete floor to slab of diamond. After a sleepless first night, he had laid out all his clothes on the bed and slept on them for a bit of cushion. All of the diplomatic staff complained about the beds, complained in private. Hans did not want to insult the hospitality of their hosts by requesting softer bedding. He also did not wish to appear weak. Everyone's back must have been hurting as much as his, from the stiff way the members of the delegation walked over to the coffee bar. Just the thought of the word bar made Hans Chotek's head throb with an impending headache. Oh, he groaned as he struggled to get out of the chair, finally using the adjacent table to pull himself up.
Those beetles can drink, eh?
If they were good hosts, Emily Perkins said, pouring a cup of coffee for herself. They would provide a plant in the corner of the conference room where we could discreetly dump our drinks when they're not looking. Hans nodded. Throughout that morning's negotiating session, he had sipped carefully on a glass of bourbon that grew more and more watery as the ice melted. The problem with letting the ice melt is their hosts noticed the liquid volume in the glass was increasing rather than dropping as expected. They then appeared very concerned, asking if the choice of spirits provided was not to the liking of their human guests. When Hans had assured them the bourbon was excellent, just becoming warm in the glass, the Jirapatha did not simply provide more ice. Before he could protest, they whisked away his half-drunk glass and provided a new, larger glass, piled high with ice, and twice as much alcohol. It was not even noon, according to his wristwatch, and he already felt like taking a nap. And an aspirin to ward off a hangover. On the other side of the table, the beetles reclined on their couches, slurped from tumblers of burgoge for the men and floon for the women, and loudly and enthusiastically belched after they took a slurp of the liquid. The repeated burping filled the room with a scent like sickly sweet cotton candy and paint thinner mixed with floor polish. The drinking on both sides had slowed down the negotiations, though not as much as the insistence by the Jirapatha on periodically halting talks to place private wagers. They wagered about how the human team would react to the next topic of discussion. They wagered on what the humans would want to talk about after that. That morning, the meeting was interrupted for the beetles to scuttle excitedly out of the room, only to return 5 minutes later. After that, it was difficult for Hans to concentrate. It seemed like the Jirapatha were watching him intently. Tension in the room ramped up as the break for lunch approached, until with 10 minutes to go, a beetle leapt to her feet, hooting triumphantly while her colleagues groaned in disgust. The reason for the celebration? She had wagered correctly about the exact moment when the last chunk of ice in Chotek's glass would melt completely. The leader of the Jirapatha declared that due to the unexpected excitement, the lunch break would be extended.
If they were good hosts, Hans whispered as he grimaced, rubbing his sore back, they would provide softer beds.
Perkins shrugged. I've slept on worse. There aren't any snakes or scorpions biting me in the night.
I wish I had your sense of perspective.
I've earned it the hard way. Lowering her voice, she added, at this rate, we won't even get to setting up a framework agreement by the end of the month.
It would help if the Jirapatha were sober and didn't have to wager about everything.
It might be more than that. He glanced over to where Takahashi stood on the other side of the room, out of hearing range.
How so?
I think the beetles are dragging things out.
They invited us here to explore the possibility of an alliance, he noted.
Yes, but they might not be in a hurry to agree on anything. It's like they want their patrons and their peers to know they're talking with us, without risking a formal break with the Rindaloo.
Irritation flashed across his face. This is all theater? Negotiations for show?
Despite his displeasure, the same thought had occurred to him.
It's not theater. It's hypothetical. The Jirapatha don't know what they want because they don't know what the strategic situation will be after we force their patrons and the Maxulks to agree to terms. Talking with the beetles first is putting the cart before the horse. Hans had heard that argument. Many in the UN staff had urged talks with the Jirapta to be postponed until after a comprehensive agreement was reached with the two senior species. The view that prevailed was that talks had to begin somewhere, and it was good for the galaxy to see that someone was taking humans seriously. Pressing a palm to his forehead, he winced.
It is building my tolerance for alcohol, so it's not...
The door to the corridor slid open, and a Jirapta bowed.
We request you return to the conference room as soon as it is convenient.
Hans checked his watch, surprised. Being closest to the doorway, he addressed the Jirapta.
We were told the midday sustenance break, he used the alien term, would be extended to...
The beetle bowed again.
My apologies. There has been a development.
She looked straight at Chotek, then at Takahashi. Hans could swear there was a twinkle in the alien's eye.
You will hopefully find it interesting.
The humans filed into the room where a small group of beetles waited, just their lead negotiator and two aides flanking her couch. She waited until the humans were all seated, then inquired if they wanted anything to drink before they began. She was looking directly at Chotek.
No,
he shook his head ruefully.
Thank you.
That seemed to amuse her, and she leaned toward the aide on her left. He glared at Chotek with a sour look, then tapped a claw on the tablet in front of him.
A wager?
Hans realized there had been a wager about whether he would request or accept another drink. Ambassador Relipinter had won that bet. It should put her in a good mood.
Perhaps later,
he added, throwing uncertainty into the question of his drinking habits. The Jirapta loved uncertainty.
Perhaps.
Relipinter clacked her mandibles together.
There has been a development, one that directly affects these negotiations.
There was a sharp intake of breath from Perkins, seated next to him. Hans felt himself tense. Another attack against Earth? He knew everyone on his side of the table had the same horrible thought. On the other side of the table, Relipinter must have understood the distress her words had caused. Her antennas waving excitedly, she added,
A positive development, which we think you will welcome.
Thank you, Takahashi said. Please, we are anxious to hear about this development.
Please understand we were just recently informed. A courier ship arrived only just before the midday sustenance break. While I have not had time to review the details, I wanted to inform you as soon as possible. A communique has been received from the Rindaloo, including a message for your people.
The lead UN negotiator's eyes darted to Chotek before he replied.
What is the message?
It is simple.
She glanced down at her tablet.
The text is, Thank you.
Chotek could not conceal his confusion.
Thank us? For what?
Apparently, your General Bishop gave the Rindaloo what I believe your people call a heads up. They acted on the information.
Yes,
Perkins said quietly, pumping a fist and thumping it softly on the table. All eyes turned to her. Most of the human eyes reproaching her for the outburst. As military liaison, she was supposed to keep quiet unless requested to speak.
Interesting.
Relipinter clacked her mandibles and addressed Perkins directly.
You knew about this then?
Perkins was aware of Takahashi glaring at her, even if she wasn't looking at him. She could feel his eyes on her.
That depends on what you are referring to.
I am referring,
Relipinter said while appraising Perkins with cool eyes,
to the doomsday plan of the Maxalks.
In that case, yes, we knew about it.
You did not think it worth mentioning to us?
That's above my pay grade, ma'am.
The bold answer seemed to amuse the three Jirapta, most especially Relipinter.
Very well. As no harm was done, we shall not speak of it now. What you should know is that the Rindaloo have destroyed the Ark ships of the Doomsday Fleet and the shipyards that were constructing those Ark ships. Also, apparently, the Maxalk's fleet that was defending that facility.
Holy shit!
That time Perkins made no attempt to be discreet. That is incredible.
Incredible that the Rindaloo were able to conduct a successful attack against such a heavily defended target?
Incredible that your patrons actually did something.
Rella Pinter laughed, her antennas dancing merrily.
We find it difficult to believe also, given our long history with our patrons. Also, we find this news encouraging. The Rindaloo are slow to act. Once roused, however, their wrath can be terrible.
Miracles can happen. By miracles, I don't mean the kind of stuff Skippy does, like warping space-time and generally pulling my sorry ass out of messes I get us into. Those are miracles, too, but we are so used to Skippy doing miraculous things that we kind of expect it. Jeez, do not tell him I said that. The miracles I'm talking about are what was waiting for us when we went outbound through the wormhole that led to Ragnar Station. Valkyrie was escorting the four Jarapta star carriers that I had promised to return as soon as we were done with them. I didn't lie about that. Not exactly. Though the Beatles would probably argue I was pushing the limit of their hospitality. Hey, while we were at Ragnar, Skippy tuned up the jump drive of those four borrowed star carriers and fixed some glitches in their power management system, so technically, we would be returning them in better than new condition. We just were not returning them right away. Like I said, we would give them back when we were done with them, and, well, we weren't done yet. See, that's what happens when you give someone a rental car with unlimited mileage. The Star Carrier Hot Streak was loaded down with six of our new Maxalt battlecruisers that had gone through basic refits at the Ragnar shipyard. The other three big space trucks had sections of the shipyard attached in what looked like the most awkward way imaginable. To make the logistics of relocating the station even more fun, part of Ragnar was continuing to service our new battlecruisers even while the station was being disassembled for transport. UNEF Command had declared they wanted our 18 new battlecruisers at Earth ASAP, and they were willing to take the risk that the Ragnar site would be attacked, a risk that grew every day we remained there. The process of getting those shipyard sections attached to the star carriers was incredibly slow. First, the sections were big. Like, when two of them were attached to a star carrier, you almost could not see the space truck at all. The only good part of the project was that the shipyard had originally been brought to the rogue planet attached to Maxalt star carriers, so they were designed to be transported. One star carrier is pretty much like any other, the main differences being how far and how many times they can jump and the amount of mass they can move between stars. So, the attachment points were not an issue. Almost all star carriers could slide their hardpoint pylons forward or back and rotate them around the spine to create four, three, or two rows of pylons. Anyway, Skippy directed the tugs and the UN Navy destroyers we used as supplemental tugs to get the sections into position without snapping the spine of a star carrier or damaging the vital piece of shipyard so it wouldn't be usable. When the last section of the first batch was secured to the star carrier Dirty Money, Skippy declared he needed a break from the painstaking process of guiding massive, awkward things through space to mate with other massive, awkward things. He needed a break from thinking at all, so I suggested we rot our brains with a Rick and Morty marathon. We chilled on the couch in my cabin, me with my feet up on the coffee table, his avatar slumped back with his tiny feet not reaching the edge of the cushion. His lordship looked so cute, I had to bite my lip not to laugh. We watched three or four Rick and Morty episodes. I kinda lost count because I was tired also, and Skippy stretched his arms and did a good imitation of a yawn.
Thanks, Joe. I needed a break.
Damn. When we started this project, I didn't expect the UN Navy to subscribe to the freaking Fleet of the Month Club, you know? Hey, this is your fault.
Mine?
You said it would take us poor monkeys forever to build our own starships. We couldn't wait. So, I shrugged. If we can't build our own starships, that leaves us with the options of buying or stealing them, right?
You mean stealing or stealing? You haven't actually paid the Jarapta other than modifying a few prototypes.
We'll get to it. They know we're busy. Besides, I don't think they care.
They don't?
Why? So far, our transactions have been sketchy ops with their ECO. Those Beatles care more about the action than the payoff. Once we start to deliver on our end of the deal, that creates sort of a formal relationship between Earth and the Jarapta government. At that point, the Beatles have to choose between an alliance with us and their client status with the Spiders.
Until we can remove the cloud threat to Earth, the Beatles aren't going to sign any official deal with us. So, in the meantime, the spiders can look the other way when ECO helps us, because so far, everything we've done hurts the Maxalts. Anyway, like I said, you brought all this work on yourself.
Ugh.
Clicking my Z-phone, I switched the wall-sized TV screen to a view of the loaded star carriers that were lined up. The Hot Streak, with our new pre-owned battle cruisers, was ready to go. It had already performed two short jumps to test the drive modifications. All we were waiting for was for the Dirty Money's structural integrity fields to adjust, compensating for the added mass of the two shipyard sections. Zooming in the view, I admired how the sections were balanced across multiple pylons.
You did a great job, buddy. Those...
Hey. I zoomed in the view again.
What the hell is that?
What are you talking about?
The big number 4 spray-painted on the end of that section.
Oh, that. There is a corresponding 4 marked on the station core where that section is supposed to go.
Neat, huh?
I had bots mark each section so I don't forget how the station goes back together. It's a complicated...
We are relying on a can of spray paint?
It's not... Okay, technically, oh my god. That is the best method you can think of? Hey, first of all, knucklehead, that station was not designed to be taken apart and reassembled. My bots had to cut away a lot of structural stuff to remove the shipyard arms from the central core. We'll have to fabricate new attachment hardware when we get to Fob Jaguar. I modeled putting the station back together using hardware I removed here and new stuff we need to make, but when I was done, I had a bunch of parts left over and I couldn't figure out where they...
You are not filling me with confidence, Skippy.
Seriously, you marked the sections with a can of spray paint and you have a plastic bag of leftover parts you don't know what to do with? My uncle is a better mechanic than...
The spray paint is just a backup, dum-dum.
Unless you want me hanging around Jaguar the whole time, someone else needs to put that thing back together. I'm working with a bunch of filthy monkeys, so...
Oh,
I buried my head in my hands. I knew this was a bad idea.
It will be fine, Joe. Have some faith. We'll figure it out.
He flashed me 2 thumbs up, then spoiled the moment by muttering, somehow?
Can you at least create a YouTube video showing that tab A goes into slot B?
Can I narrate the video in the form of an epic opera?
No.
Hmm. Then I guess a bunch of monkey engineers are going to have a big pile of paper instructions spread out on the floor of a cargo bay and...
I'm serious, Skippy.
You seriously never want me to have any fun. We worked out a compromise, where if monkey engineers ever did have to get involved in reassembling Ragnar Station, they had to listen to Skippy's operatic narration the first time through the instructions. Yes, you could have heard the thump-thump as I threw the engineer team under a bus, but if we had to rely on monkeys to put that station back together, we would be in huge trouble. Anyway, we escorted the 4 heavily laden star carriers out through the wormhole without incident and began the monotonous jump-recharge-jump process toward the wormhole that led to our forward operating base. Along the way, Valkyrie took a short detour to check in with a relay station, where we heard about the miracle. Our negotiation team had been invited to a meeting with the Rindaloo and Maxalks, a preliminary meeting to lay the ground rules for actual negotiations that would probably drag on forever, and that's okay with me. Also, the meeting was being set up by the Rindaloo, and while they had also invited the Maxalks, there was no guarantee the kiddies would actually show up. But, according to the spiders, the Maxalks supposedly had agreed in principle that they would talk with us. So,
that's progress, I guess.
If the senior species stopped shooting at us while we were talking, we could disperse the cloud away from our home planet, restore Earth's economy, finally deliver technology upgrades to the Jarraptha, and... Well, we would move on to deal with the next crisis. The details needed to be hammered out in what would very likely be long and tedious discussions, but the Rindaloo had agreed in principle to several of our major needs and redlined some of my demands they found totally unacceptable. In the good news column, there is a reason for the Maxalts agreeing that they at least might talk with us. That reason is the Rindaloo gave them a serious beatdown at the star system where the Doomsday Fleet was being constructed. After their plan to wake up Sentinels and bail out of the galaxy was ruined, the assholes in charge of the hegemony didn't have the option of triggering Sentinels anymore, unless they wanted to commit suicide.
The Rindaloo stated they would not interfere with our efforts to deal with the cloud, and they would not interfere with our attempts to get assistance from other species, and that they would intervene if the Rotten Kitties tried to stop us from dispersing the cloud. That was all good news, huh? You haven't heard the bad news. At the very top of the bad news column, I had to list the fact that the Maxulks only agreed to entertain talking with us because those assholes no longer had the option of a small group of their people surviving the complete destruction of all intelligent life in the galaxy. That really shook me. Captain Scarandum was right. I had seriously, dangerously underestimated the fragile egos of the Maxulks. After I threatened their empire, they had been ready, they had been preparing to kill everyone, just so their sick culture could have a small chance to survive and dominate the galaxy at some far future date. You can't negotiate with delusional fanatics like them. But somehow we had to find a way to negotiate. Somehow the Rotten Kitties had to find a way to swallow their pride. The Maxulks would not be negotiating in good faith. Although really, nobody expected them to, so maybe that doesn't matter. Second item on the bad news list is that neither the Kitties nor Spiders would help to get rid of the cloud for us. Truthfully, that is both bad news and good news. If the senior species could have snapped their fingers or claws and banished the cloud, that would be great. But if their project to disperse the cloud required either of them to establish a major presence in our solar system, that was too much of a risk for us. Now that we had a method of taking care of the cloud by ourselves, we really did not need either of the supreme a-holes to be hanging around our quaint little home world. In other bad news, the Rindaloo did not agree to my demands to allow their clients to sign mutual defense treaties with us. The best we could do was an either-or situation. Either the clients had the protection of their current patrons, or they relied entirely on Earth for defense. The Giraptha, for example, could not have it both ways. If the Beatles signed a deal with us, they would no longer be under the umbrella of protection offered by the Rindaloo. That was bad news, but only sort of. There would be plenty of loopholes we could exploit. The Rindaloo could not afford to lose major clients, so they would probably tolerate a significant degree of cooperation between Earth and their clients, as long as that cooperation did not result in a formal break of the patron-client relationship. There was other bad news that really was bad news, and it was part of the good news. The Rindaloo pledged to not commit hostile action against Earth or other human interests, and they would intervene if the Kitties attacked Earth. Great, huh? Yeah, except that left a big loophole. Like a loophole you could fly a starship through. The bad guys could encourage a supposedly rogue client species to commit hostile action against us, and it would be tough for us to prove the seniors were directly involved. The definition of human interests also needed to be very strictly defined, or we might discover that, for example, our people on Paradise were not covered under the agreement. My fear was that someone smart would get one of their clients to launch an attack against Earth to see how we responded. Shit, that would be a problem. Like a big fucking problem. UNEF Command would demand that Skippy shut down a wormhole network of the guilty client, which, of course, we couldn't do, and our whole greatest bluff of all time would be exposed. Crap. Both the Maxulks and Rindaloo were smart. Of course they would use a client to test us. How do I know that? Because I would do it, and I am only a filthy, ignorant monkey. So, while I plastered an idiot grin on my face when I told the crew the good news, inside I was feeling sick. The worst part was I couldn't tell anyone about my fears. That is the downside of being a lying sack of shit. In the meantime, I had a job to do. We escorted the Star Carriers to Jaguar, where the engineering teams began the painstaking process of removing the Ragnar shipyard sections and placing them in a stable orbit. After a brief conference with Admiral Zhao, we went outbound through the wormhole again, making me feel like a freaking yo-yo. With us was our borrowed Star Carrier Hotstreak and six refitted battlecruisers. Six was a good number, one for each of the permanent UNEF members, plus one that, my guess, was supposed to be sort of a timeshare for all the other nations of Earth. We arrived back at our homeworld. Valkyrie remained in stealth, without any word from the Flying Dutchman about how negotiations were going. Whatever, I couldn't worry about that. UNEF Command decided that 5 of the battlecruisers would remain in Earth orbit, and 1 would escort Valkyrie while Skippy did his magic solar flare thing. That was a great, fantastic, excellent plan, except for the fact that those new battlecruisers barely had enough qualified crews to make them operational. The priority for staffing those ships were people who understood the basics of how to make those incredibly complex ships fly and fight so they could train others. Admiral Zhao had given me messages to carry to UNEF Command, pleading for more personnel at Jaguar. The UN Navy unexpectedly now had more ships than crews to operate them, and new people would face a steep learning curve, no matter how qualified they were in their specialties on Earth. We also did not know the best tactics for deploying squadrons of battlecruisers without escort vessels, and we sure as hell had no idea how to manage the complicated tactics of a fleet that was split into 2 very distinctive capabilities. Should our former Maxulk's battlecruisers act as a vanguard force to provide cover for the former Jarapta ships? Or designate the former Jarapta ships of the 1st and 2nd Fleet as sort of a gator navy to handle planetary assaults and bombardments, while the battlecruiser squadrons got the glamorous jobs of establishing and maintaining space supremacy in the area? Hey, don't look at me. I am not an expert on how to handle formations of warships in combat. That's outside my specialty, which is... apparently my specialty is getting into trouble that I don't know how to get out of. And somehow getting out of trouble in a way that gets us into even more trouble because of the law of unintended consequences. I hate that freaking law. Unfortunately, the happy notion of our new battlecruisers acting as a top-tier defense force for our homeworld ran into the messy reality that the nations operating those ships were still under great stress from the cloud that was approaching Earth, and the fact that the member nations of UNEF simply did not trust each other during the crisis. The trouble began when China refused to send their new battlecruiser away from Earth with Valkyrie unless the Indian and American ships left orbit. You might think Britain and France had no fears of each other, but that wasn't true. They were each competing to secure land rights in Africa in case the cloud could not be stopped, and having a battlecruiser overhead was a powerful aid in negotiations, if you know what I mean. All 5 permanent members of UNEF had objections to leaving their people unprotected while any other nation had a battlecruiser in orbit, so that left 1 ship to accompany Valkyrie. 1 ship that had most of its crew stripped away to staff the others. 1 ship that originally didn't even have a name because UNEF couldn't agree on a name or even a framework for selecting a name. The name could not be anything from the languages of China, India, Britain, France, or America, because those nations already got to name their own ships. The compromise was to name the ship Valiente, the Spanish word for valiant. That name satisfied the people of Spain, Central, and South America, and it was close enough to the Portuguese word Valencia that the Brazilians did not object. Politics suck. So, with the Valiente pulling crew from Valkyrie, even though we really couldn't afford to run our own ship for very long with fewer people, we jumped toward the sun for Skippy to begin performing the stressful and tedious task of creating 1 small solar flare after another. The crew was so looking forward to dealing with a stressed, irritated, and bored Skippy for week after monotonous week. Not.